Fourth case for argument this morning is United States against Senner. Mr. Pence.
Good morning. May it please the court. What is most troubling in this case is that the district court increased Mr. Senner's sentence by 18 months over the high end of the guideline range. Now, this increase was due primarily, if not completely, to the legal arguments made during the sentencing hearing. The district court admitted on page 98 of the transcript that had Mr. Senner not uttered a syllable at the sentencing hearing, there would have been no increase over the high end. Now, these were legal arguments that were admittedly flawed and perhaps misguided. But we're talking about a 19 or 20-year-old.
Suppose he had stood up and said, you know, robbing banks is really a lot of fun. As soon as I get out, I plan to rob as many additional banks as I can. Would that be a good ground for the district judge to increase his sentence?
It would be. And the difference between your hypothetical and this particular situation...
A large chunk of your argument is the district court is not supposed to respond adversely to what the defendant says in allocution. But allocution is somehow a one-way street. It can lead to a lower sentence, but it can never lead to a higher sentence. You've just agreed it can lead to a higher sentence, too, if he says something implying that he's more dangerous. That then leads to the main question. It doesn't what he said, which is there's no law against what I'm doing, imply that he's more dangerous?
Respectfully, what we're arguing is not that there's not the district court doesn't have the power to increase a sentence based on what transpires at the hearing itself or the sentencing hearing. We're arguing that for such an increase to come about, there has to be an accurate assessment of the circumstances of the case as well as the increase itself being reasonable. And in this particular case, that didn't happen. The district court in this matter said that Mr. Senner was using the law to further his own ends or for his own interests. Now, most people probably appearing before a court will do something involving their own self-interest. That's part of the process of advocacy. But the court here interpreted this as being somehow a denial of responsibility or a lack of remorse. And the district court charged Mr. Senner with denigrating the law and simply using it to serve his own interest in this regard.
Isn't that sensible understanding? If somebody stands up and says, there is just no law against what I'm doing, and anybody who thinks that what I am doing is illegal is deluded, and that's what Senner said, isn't this person not only denying remorse, he's saying it's perfectly legal what I did. And he's revealing himself to be more dangerous.
Respectfully, he didn't actually make those assessments. The court, if you look at page 89, or excuse me, 60, says that the transcript, Mr. Senner says he's not entitled to rob banks and that he is subject to various jurisdictions. He just happens to want to be before the state court instead of the federal court. On page 88, he acknowledges that the...
It wasn't illegal under state law, if I recall correctly.
In the motion, he may have questioned
that. He wanted to be before state court, and if he were in state court, he'd say it's not illegal there either.
At the sentencing hearing itself, which is really what we're looking at, given what the district court tells us it used for this increase, he said that he would be under the jurisdiction of the state court. And on page 88 of the sentencing transcript, he says that the district court probably is within its right to rule on this matter. He just wanted to raise the issue regarding whether it was proper to be raised in state court. And on page 91, he does show remorse. There's an entire discussion by him of the things he's done wrong in his life and that he wants to change, wants to make things better. Now, there's this issue of him denying responsibility or accountability. And while he doesn't admit his guilt, the trial counsel during the sentencing hearing makes the point that he doesn't have to, and that's right. Now, he couches his legal arguments in this hypothetical guilt. He says, were I guilty of this crime, it would probably be better under the state court rather than the federal. And this is probably something that he learned in his various legal research and reading. But this itself is not a denial of responsibility. Now, the district court and the government will no doubt cite Smith out of the Ninth Circuit as an example of an analogous case. But the facts of that case are readily distinguishable from the facts of this case. Judge Easterbrook, like your hypothetical, we have a defendant here who denies that there is a crime and denies that the law has any power over him involving those crimes. This involved tax fraud and mail fraud. He showed open contempt for the court and was antagonistic with the judge. That simply didn't happen in this particular case. Mr. Sander was not disrespectful and went out of his way to show as much respect for the court as he could while raising these procedural questions. He also did not deny responsibility, and he admitted that bank robbery itself was a crime that had to come with a punishment and that he would be subject to it if guilty. What's particularly troubling in this case with the justification of the court is that there's an issue here with Judge Grady being perhaps understandably but annoyed with Mr. Sander and the general jailhouse litigation jailhouse luring that he sees come through his court. The problem with this and why it's unfair to increase the sentence by 18 months is there was a discussion between the court and Mr. Sander that went on for a long time where each side engaged the other in these legal arguments. In fact, starting on page 58 of the transcript, the district court twice specifically encourages Mr. Sander to expand and explain his legal arguments. Two other instances gave permission for Mr. Sander to continue to make these legal arguments. So to then say that had he not uttered a syllable during the sentencing hearing itself seems unfair and illogical. If the purpose of this is to deter this type of behavior, it seems rather unreasonable and unfair to then encourage the defendant to actually do that at the sentencing hearing. And if we are concerned here about deterring this jailhouse luring, what would have been much more reasonable by the district court would be to take one of two options: either ignore the legal arguments completely or to actually stop the defendant from making them. This court in Alden makes it clear that that does not violate a defendant's right of allocution to point out that the arguments are relevant and to move on. And if we're worried about deterring this jailhouse luring, that would be a better alternative.
We've come that far. If you're a history buff, you may be aware that one of the articles of impeachment against Justice Samuel Chase was that he had stopped a defendant from making a legally frivolous argument. The House thought that every defendant has a right to make arguments as frivolous as he pleases, but at least the Senate acquitted Justice Chase of that charge. So,
well, and in this case, the court has,
I think, is on a, I presume, no risk of being impeached for stopping frivolous arguments today.
Well,
I don't read the point of this above guideline sentences being aimed at deterring this sort of conduct anyway. I think it's just the district court's assessment of the defendant's character and rehabilitative potential and likelihood of recidivism, which are all perfectly appropriate factors for the judge to consider in exceeding the guidelines.
And Judge Grady does address those issues on page 98, but on the very next page, 99, says that part of the justification for this is to show the court's disagreement, a strong disagreement, with the use of the law in this way. And by that, he means this particular argument's being raised at the sentencing hearing.
Where's the evidence that other defendants raise that same argument? I'm a sovereign. I'm not subject to federal law.
Earlier in the transcript, I think at page 89, Mr. Sander is questioned several times by Judge Grady, saying, have you talked to various other defendants, and specifically names one, and said he's come before this court and made similar arguments. And so he questions Mr. Sander whether he had talked to other people. So it's obvious here that we're seeing an annoyance at a pattern of behavior before the court. But again, this was encouraged by Judge Grady. Several points within the sentencing hearing, and he had, at any point could have stopped the arguments from being made or simply ignored them. So to punish someone 18 months over the high end of their sentence, a sentence that now totals 15 years, seems to be eminently unreasonable. Looking at this under 3553A, the first sentence to 3553 says that with whatever factors we take into consideration, the sentence itself should be sufficient but not greater than necessary. I realize I've gone a little over into my rebuttal time, so I'd like to reserve the rest of that.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
You will have about a minute. Thank you, Mr. Pence. Ms. Rodney.
May it please the Court, Renee Rodney on behalf of the United States. Good morning, Your Honors. I guess I'll begin with the argument put forward by the appellant here at oral argument that he was denied his right to allocution because he received a sentence over the guideline range. I think this Court has already recognized that it's perfectly acceptable within
the most recent formulation of it was the district court should have denied him his right of allocution before he stepped on the landmine.
Well, the district court certainly allowed the appellant to express what sentence he deserved over the course of a two-day hearing.
Gave him enough rope to hang himself, although he did not, in fact, sentence him to capital punishment.
Right. Well, Your Honor, as very familiar with the Section 3553A factors, directs the district court to consider not only the nature and circumstances of the offense, but the history and characteristics of the defendant, which includes statements that are made during allocution. And the district court in this case not only considered the defendant's statements at allocution, he looked at the defendant's pro se filings that he had submitted after his trial. He looked at his conduct during the trial, the fact that he committed perjury at the suppression hearing, at the trial, and took all of those things into account in determining that a sentence above the guideline range was appropriate. Because the defendant's sentence was based in the 3553A factors, I think this court should affirm it as reasonable. I had intended to spend a bit more time on the other issue in this case. It's the government's position that the district court correctly included the value of the stolen getaway car in its loss amount calculation. The district court's methodology is clearly supported by the language of the robbery guideline.
There's just one factual matter I wanted to make sure I understand about the car. Was the car returned or was it abandoned and then later recovered?
The appellant and his co-defendants abandoned the car. It was located by law enforcement the day of the robbery and returned 4 days later to its true owner.
Right. Do you think it would be appropriate to add the whole value of the car if the defendant stole the car, drove it right back, parked it back where it had been, and walked away before he was caught?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the fact that the defendants stole the car indicates some intent to permanently deprive the victim of it.
Is there a general rule in the guidelines that loss doesn't count if full restitution is made before the defendant is caught? I mean, imagine the case of Sanner walks into the bank, says, give me all your money. They give him $50,000. He walks out of the bank, and he just turns around, comes back in, and says, no, I'm not that kind of person. I'm not doing that. Here's the money back. And then surrenders. Would that be treated as a $50,000 loss?
Yes, Your Honor, for purposes of determining the offense level for punishment for that defendant.
You think there is no principle that if the money is given back before the person is caught, there is any discount? I think we've established that if the money is given back before apprehension, that it doesn't all count.
Your Honor, I'm not familiar with that portion of the guidelines, but since loss is defined as the value of the property taken, damaged, or destroyed, that taken money would go towards calculating his offense level.
See, we've had this in bank cases. Since, as you say, the car was abandoned, it doesn't come up here. We've had this in bank cases where somebody commits fraud to get a loan. Right? You lie to the bank in order to get a $1 million loan. If you're caught before you pay the $1 million back, then the $1 million is loss, even if you plan to pay it back or actually pay it back. But we've had cases where the defendant has actually repaid the $1 million before he gets caught. And then the question is, what's the loss?
Right. I think the guidelines for determining loss in fraud cases goes to the intended loss, which can go towards the offense level, but the actual loss then comes into play when you're talking about restitution owed to the victim. But under the robbery guideline, the value of the property taken is important to determining what the appropriate offense level is here. So whether or not the robber is caught as soon as he walks out of the bank and that bank is ultimately made whole if that amount of money stolen is over
$10,000. No. You didn't get my hypothetical. I didn't say caught before he walks out of the bank. What all my hypotheticals have in common is the money is given back before he is caught. That is, completely voluntarily, before he is caught. Now, you say that that's not what happened with this car, so we don't have to worry about that. But that's the set of cases I'm worried about.
The timing of when a particular defendant is caught after committing the offense should have no impact on whether the value of the property stolen is incorporated into that person's loss amount calculation. Here, Your Honors, the district court included the amount of money stolen and the value of the car that was stolen to use as a getaway vehicle. That amount exceeded $10,000, which caused the appellant to receive a one-level increase in his offense level calculation. It's the government's position that the district court correctly calculated the loss calculation for the appellant in this case, and we would ask that his sentence be affirmed. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Rodney. Anything further, Mr. Pence?
I realize I'm almost out of time, but I wanted to point out that we largely stand on the arguments we made in the brief on the loss calculation issue. But I wanted to point out that this court in Donaby determined that the district court in that case correctly determined the loss calculation using the damage, not the full value of the vehicle itself. And the government has pointed to no case which contradicts that is binding on this court. So here, the damage rather than the full value itself is the correct calculation. Donaby also actually referenced both figures within that sentence to show the discrepancy between them. And that itself is in harmony with the guidelines. And in the background to 2B3.1, there's reference to the fact that we do tend to impose conservative principles on loss calculation because of the fact that the offense level itself is such a high base offense level at 20 with robbery. So in that case, we think that this was error and should be reversed for that reason alone. Thank the court for its time, and we request that it reverse this to remain for a more suitable sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pence. And Dean Rebell, we want to thank you and the Legal Aid Clinic for accepting this appointment and the assistance you've been to your client and to the court as well. The case is taken under advisement. We'll hear argument.